You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's show, from Montreal to Libya, we'll review the day's top stories with Martin Plaut and Shashank Joshi here in the studio. Then we head to Davos, where Bloomberg's Matthew Campbell sets the scene.
There are certainly some dark clouds. One of them is the recent NSA spying revelations, which have been the subject of questions to various people today again and again and again.
Our transport editor heads to Houston to explore the future of NASA.
We have an asteroid initiative out there right now where we want to actually go send a robotic spacecraft, capture an asteroid, tow it back to orbit around the moon, and then send astronauts in Orion to visit it.
And later in the show,
there's no dark like a winter night in the country. And there was a wind like this one tonight, howling and whistling in off the sea. It was this type of night now. Am I setting the scene for you?
We'll review the latest in theater releases with Matt Wolf of the International New York Times. All that plus a check-in with our woman in Athens. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, here is David Spencer with the latest news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Syria's government and opposition have angrily spelled out their mutual hostility at a peace conference that's begun in Switzerland. Opposition leader Ahmed Jabbar accused the president of Nazi-style war crimes and demanded the Syrian government delegation sign up to an international plan for handing over power. But Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualam insisted Assad would not bow to outside demands. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has warned both sides that terrorists in Syria are benefiting from the civil war.
We are urging that there is no other options, that by establishing transitional governing body who will have full power over military, security and intelligence, then let the person with the vision for the better future govern this one and try to put forward their proposals.
At least three people have been killed in violent clashes between anti-government protesters and riot police in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. Demonstrators are angry at new laws passed last week aimed at clamping down on the protests, which started late last year over the president's rejection of an EU trade deal. The president has held talks with the opposition today in a bid to end the violence. Two coal miners have been killed in a methane gas blast in Siberia. The victims were among 105 miners who'd been underground at the time of the blast. The rest made it safely to the surface. Despite improvements in safety standards, fatal accidents are frequent in Russia's aging pits. Most accidents have been attributed to methane gas blast, negligence, or a failure to follow safety regulations. Eurozone government debt has fallen for the first time in nearly 6 years. The figures for the third quarter of 2013 add to signs that the bloc is emerging from its crisis, even if the debt level remains well above the EU's limit. Sovereign debt fell as a proportion of national output in all three of the Eurozone's biggest economies, Germany, France and Italy, as well as in Portugal. But debt rose relative to GDP in Greece, where the debt crisis began, and Spain, which took a bailout for its banks. Gunmen in Pakistan have shot dead six guards protecting a Spanish round-the-world cyclist in a remote area in the west of the country. Javier Colorado suffered minor wounds in the attack, and six other guards were also injured. Yesterday, in the same region, a bus bomb killed 24 Shiite pilgrims. Police said they didn't know why Colorado was cycling through such a dangerous area. The European Union set out new climate and energy goals for 2030. It's proposed less stringent targets than in the past in a reflection of tougher economic conditions and a desire to limit rising energy costs. The European Commission said EU governments should face a single binding target to cut carbon emissions by 40% compared with 1990 levels. Commission President José Manuel Barroso presented the proposal as a marriage between industry and climate action.
What we are presenting today is both ambitious and affordable. It shows that we are beyond debate, where you had to either be green or a defender of industry. We believe these two issues are not contradictory, but can perfectly go together if handled smartly.
European Commission President José Manuel Barroso. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. We'll get more news at Line Zero Monocle 24 in about 25 minutes. You're listening to Midori House. We are back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Oplondo, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this er Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it's 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news is Martin Plaut, former Africa editor for BBC World Service News and senior research fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme.
Thanks very much.
Let's start the show in Montreal, where diplomats are sitting at a table with their sleeves rolled up, trying to solve a seemingly unsolvable problem: how to end the Syrian civil war. Expectations are not high, and there has already been some very direct language at the conference when representatives of the Syrian government and the opposition have been meeting there. First, looking at previous examples of peace conferences in general, what are the main factors that can create a successful peace conference?
I think above all, both combatants have to be utterly exhausted and persuaded that there's nothing to be gained by fighting on, that they can gain more from striking a compromise than they can from staying in the fight and improving their position. That is a condition that is certainly not in evidence in Syria today. There are both sides attempting to make as many military gains as they can right up to the conference itself. They have almost zero interest in the ostensible purpose, which is a transitional government of mutual consent. So this certainly is no Dayton Accord, as we saw in the Balkans in the 90s or anything like that.
What do you say, Martin?
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, if you look at the situation in Northern Ireland, again, both sides realised that there was no way forward. Or even in South Africa, rather to everyone's surprise, in the 80s and 90s, the South African government realised that they had to make a settlement, and that continuing the fight against the ANC would not produce any results. But we are nowhere near this. There's plenty more fighting still to be done. The real question, I think, is why this is being brought together. And I can only assume that it is really because people are so shocked and horrified by the, whatever it is, 100,000 dead and 3 or 4 million people in exile. They feel they must do something. Well, this is the must do something conference.
Exactly. Is there anything the organizers can do to make even something achievable happen?
Well, I think they can, relieve the suffering at the margins. They can certainly, more money can be pumped into places like Jordan and Turkey to assist the refugees when they go across the border. But, in the end, this is a fight, really, let's be honest. It's a fight between Syria on the one hand, between Iran on the one hand, and the Saudis on the other, representing the Shia and the Sunni. And, that is nowhere going to end. They will continue funding that fight because they have vital interests in the outcome. And until that is resolved, there's no way forward.
If we continue by talking about the general psychology of this kind of peace conferences, how important is the location? I'm thinking of Montreal with its beautiful lakeside scenery. Does it make a difference psychologically when you have people negotiating when they are far away from home and they feel that?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Some people would suggest that the more desolate and awful the situation you're negotiating in, and you lock the disputants into a room together, the more quickly they want to escape as fast as possible. In this particular case, of course, they only have a place to return to that is horribly war-ridden, and so there's incentives to stay. I think it's not just a question of how far away you are. It's also a question of who is brokering the conference. Are there honest brokers? The venue is less important than who are the people overseeing the rules and oversetting the way it operates. And today we got a very good example of that. Ban Ki-moon exhorted all the participants to be civil, not to throw accusations, to be polite, and everyone immediately ignored him. When the bell began ringing to say to the Syrian foreign minister, you have to stop now, he ignored it and snapped back at Ban Ki-moon, I'm from Syria, you're from New York, shut up. Without the shut up, of course, but that's what he was thinking. And so I think one of the problems here is the UN doesn't really have a grip on this. And we saw that not just in the operation of the conference today, but also in the debacle over the invitation and disinvitation of Iran.
What do you think? What is the best possible outcome from these peace talks now?
I think that the best outcome is that you might find that a permanent group are established who will take the process forward and begin to find where the synergies are, if there are any. There might also perhaps be some agreement on, shall we say, some corridors to bring in some kind of relief, maybe medical aid or food aid into certain areas which are besieged. But since, you know, quite frankly at the moment, food is a weapon of war, so are medical supplies. Why is it in anybody's interest to allow them through? This is a conflict that, frankly, has to burn itself out. There's no way around it, I don't think.
I think from the point of view of the Americans, any agreement on further talks would be a success, because having this is historic. As one Syrian commented in the New York Times today, this is like the Stalinists sitting down with the White Russians. These are people in the regime who just haven't seen opposition activists in decades. So around the same table, even if you're hurling invective, I mean, that is a small type of success, some might say.
You've basically made it clear, very clear, that not much is to be expected from these peace talks. But is there a chance that this event could take the situation in Syria even to a worse direction?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we're already seeing only last week another bombing in southern Beirut claimed by the Syrian al-Qaeda branch Jabhat al-Nusra. We're already seeing an out-and-out uprising in cities of Anbar province in Iraq with the same Iraqi al-Qaeda group ISIS that is active in Syria. For me, it's only a matter of time before we start seeing small bombings in places in Jordan and Turkey. That will be occurring within the next year, I think.
And of course, you have the possibility, which is already beginning to happen, of Lebanon being drawn into the conflict. So you really have a regional conflict. And I mean, this was underlined for me way back when the first beginnings of the Arab Spring took place, and I was in Cairo, and we were interviewing some of the senior people. And we were brought into the foreign ministry, and he said, you know, off the record, they said, you know, what are you doing? Why are you allowing this to continue? Don't you realize in the end you will have a sheer arc through the whole region? And that was their great concern, their great worry. And, you know, that at the end of the day is what this is all about. Who is going to win in this terrible split within Islam?
Marcin and Zhazheng, let's stay close to Montreux and head to the small alpine town of Davos, where the global elite convene each year for the World Economic Forum. Later in the show, we'll hear from Bloomberg's Matt Campbell on the scene. But for now, I wanted to ask you for your thoughts of this event. How useful do you think an event like this can be?
Oh, I think it's absolutely vital. You know, you've got to see that these people get together, you know, on many occasions. This is not the only one. One shouldn't forget that the elite get together at places like Bilderberg, which has been going on now since 1954. Very, even more elite gathering, only by invitation, behind closed doors, never discuss what's happening. And, you know, there's a wonderful phrase by Adam Smith, which he said many, many years ago. People of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices. And quite frankly, nothing has changed.
What do you think, Shashank, about the importance?
I slightly disagree. I think it's a sort of a souped-up G20, but with wider access for corporate executives. I am rather impressed that Hassan Rouhani is going to Davos this year, which I think is a bit of a mark of Iran's easing isolation and his interest in easing sanctions. So anything that gets him closer to Western leaders, I think, is a good opportunity for dialogue. What really struck me from today's sessions at Davos, which, of course, in this era of Twitter, were live-tweeted to the world, and I'm sure Davos organisers lament that, was Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe saying the situation in Asia was indeed between Japan and China was just like that between Germany and Britain in 1914. And I thought, for all the 1914 analogies we've been seeing, to hear the Japanese Prime Minister himself endorse one alarmed me like nothing else.
So, Marty, when you were talking about the importance of this and you think there is a significance, can you give us some concrete examples of how the world has actually benefited from existence of World Economic Forum?
No, I can't, but that's the point. That is precisely the point. This is all the real work is done off the record. It's in those quiet one-to-one meetings between these top leaders. That is why they go. They don't go for the set piece events. Yes, of course, they all want to be on Facebook. They all want to be on Twitter. They all want to show that they are making a big show of these things. But the point is the quiet diplomacy and the discussions. It's all, you know, that is what these things are about. They are not about what happens in public. They're what happens in private.
Are you saying that this event wouldn't be as effective if it was more transparent?
Yes, precisely. It's precisely the closed nature of these events that makes them worthwhile. What you say in public is of no interest, essentially. What you say in private, away from the glare of the television cameras, that is where the real
work happens.
Which
I think creates a certain degree of tension in an age where we are all very conscious of newspaper proprietors meeting with politicians in Downing Street, of private corporate influence on government, of a democratic deficit. If the very functioning of these institutions depends on secrecy and opacity, it's very hard to square that with the way government has to operate today, which is in a very open fashion, with interests declared and the public able to monitor who is meeting whom.
But I mean, you look at someone like I was just looking at the papers from 1984, which were revealed between Thatcher and Botha. When Botha comes over to the UK and Mrs. Thatcher. Where was the real business done? It was done in those 40 minutes where there were no officials and no minute takers. That is where the real business happens. And quite frankly, it has always been thus.
Doesn't it create bad blood anyway that it's so closed and so few are invited there?
Who cares? It's where the business happens. You cannot do real business. Look, I was once worked for Mobil Oil as an industrial relations advisor. And there were these huge set piece discussions between the two sides, between union and the company, on how to make the deal. Let me tell you where the real decisions were made. They were made just before lunch in the toilet. Because the two sides, the two key people would stand there in the urinal and the one would say, do you think we'd take 5%? The other would say, well, if it was 4.5%, we'd probably do it. Well, and that was it. That was the deal. All the rest was nonsense.
I have some sympathy for this view. And I look at this in the context of, say, the Iran nuclear deal we've just struck. It was possible only because there was a long secret back channel between the US and Iran in Oman, hosted by the Sultan of Oman in his palaces, in hotels, in private, very quietly. We could not have got the deal we did in Geneva if we didn't have that back channel. I'm wary of having corporate and private interests inject themselves into that same process, but I do understand the need for secrecy.
We have to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Marco Sippi, and Martin Plaut and Shashank Joshi will still be here when we return, and we are in North Africa up next. Stay tuned.
The February issue of Monocle will help you plot your global progress in 2014. Turn the pages to find the villages, cities, and nations you need to visit for inspiration, work, and play. Whether you're looking for a new HQ, want to get that movie made, or perhaps are a spy, we'll tell you how to plan your itinerary.
Where do you go it alone? The forest in Oregon. What is the best place to set up a design shop? That'll be Taiping Shang in Hong Kong. And a furniture studio? Danzigerstrasse in Berlin. In the design section, we've crossed the globe to discover the places we'll have designs on in 2014.
In the edit section, we charter a new course for 2014 from behind the kitchen counters of Flanders, Belgium's up-and-coming culinary destination. We interview the rising chefs and food growers that are changing the region's image and putting it on the gastronomic map. We also take a sip of Georgian wine and Mexican coffee, some of the indispensable products in Monocle's pantry for this year.
The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Martin Plaut, Senior Research Fellow at Institute of Commonwealth Studies and Shezheng Joshi Research Fellow at RUSI. Let's turn now to Egypt, where last week Egyptians voted on a constitutional referendum, and now ex-president Mohamed Morsi has just been ordered to go on trial on the 16th of February on foreign conspiracy charges. Human rights organizations have expressed their concern already. How politically motivated do you think these prosecutions are?
Of the Brotherhood? I mean, entirely politically motivated. nearly anything the Brotherhood stands accused of, and many of these charges were quite reasonable ones, is nothing the regime itself and the army itself has not done in spades. So, frankly, you know, what we are seeing is just one small chunk of a giant offensive against the Brotherhood, an attempt to crush the organization by a regime that is pretty drunk on power, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, the tragedy is that the Brotherhood, you know, I met some of their leaders before they came to power in London. They came over and they said, look, you know, we're good guys. We're going to be fine. There's not going to be a problem if we come to power. But they handled power so badly. And, you know, they did attempt to, you know, change the constitution in their favor so that nobody would ever have another chance at taking power. And the army just eventually said, no, this is not going to happen. And they stepped in and now they've got everybody on the run. And in a sense, what we're seeing is a rerun of what happened first in Algeria when the FIS took power through elections. And they were overthrown. And quite frankly, this is the pattern that has been played out again and again across North Africa. And it's tragic because, you know, these people spent years in opposition. And now they are in jail and facing trial.
So, Martin, basing on all that, how predictable is the result of this trial?
Oh, I think entirely predictable. I think if this judge won't find him guilty, then somebody else will.
It's as predictable as the result of the constitutional referendum, in which an astonishing 98-99% of Egyptians voted in favour of the constitution. Numbers I certainly haven't seen for a long time, since Saddam Hussein used to have his elections.
And we're looking at Morsi as a figure. How much power does he still have?
I don't think he has much power left because, you know, his people are in jail. You know, yes, he's still a you know, symbolic figure, but I mean, you know, what can he do? He doesn't have the ability to influence things on the ground. And, you know, it used to be always said that Middle East was decided on the streets. What would the streets stand for? Well, he can't mobilize people on the streets sufficiently to face the army, and so that's really, frankly, the end of him for the time being.
There are some people in the Brotherhood who would like to portray Morsi as Egypt's Nelson Mandela, which is one of the funniest things I've heard in a long time. The leadership of the Brotherhood has been shattered, and in fact, that's going to cause problems because the moderating influences of the senior Islamist leadership are being stripped away, and you're seeing more radical, younger leaders fill in that vacuum, and they're not happy with the way things are going.
There is a possibility of death sentence for Morsi as well. How probable do you think that is?
I think they'd be mad to impose it, because it would precisely create a martyr. And I think they'd be much better advised to not to go down that route. But I don't know. What do you think?
No, I agree. They are prone to sort of pushing nationalist opinion. They feel they're riding a wave of anti-brotherhood sentiment, which I think is genuine and keen, sincerely felt in Egypt. But I think they recognised it. To actually kill him would be to go a step too far. They are far better off looking at least magnanimous in that way. But otherwise, I think they will otherwise spare no effort in crushing the Brotherhood's other arms.
And of course, the one other thing to remember is that you have this terrible tension in Western policy. Well, on the one hand, you know, the West keeps going on about how it's necessary to have democracy and freedom and liberty and all the rest of it. And oh my God, when people actually do it and vote for you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, then of course everyone says, oh no, it can't go that way.
Is there a lesson that can be learned from all this we've seen taking place there?
Yeah, I think it's very simple. Don't try and hoard power. That's a very simple lesson. Look at Tunisia. Look at even Libya and other countries where Islamists have come to power. They've had issues, they've had teething problems, but they haven't treated politics as a zero-sum game. They haven't tried to change the rules to squeeze their opponents out and entrench themselves permanently. That is what Morsi did, and that is what the army have done too, now creating a military state that for me resembles Pakistan or somewhere else. Without that lesson, Egypt will not have reconciliation.
Let's leave Egypt for a while and let's move on to Libya, where the country's second largest party in the interim administration, the Justice and Construction Party, has just announced it is quitting the government. Five ministers will resign. What is the background for this?
Well, it's an Islamist party. They didn't do very well at the election, which is an interesting anomaly in the Arab Spring. They were Islamists who failed. They had a couple of key ministries, including oil, and they want to topple the Prime Minister, Ali Zeidan, and they think on the pretext that he didn't protect oil installations. In fact, they've been trying to get rid of him for ages, and now they've decided to throw a bit of a tantrum when they can to try and bring down the government. And all it does is polarise Libya's awful fragmented politics even more.
Where does this leave Libya?
In just a deeper mess than it was a week ago, and which is to say, an enormous mess. They're trying to put a constitution together. They're trying to stop militias taking over the state. They're trying to get oil pumping again, which has been subject to strikes and protests. So the Prime Minister is hanging on by his fingertips, and I think, you know, he will just be hoping he can cobble together a government to hang on until a new parliament is formed, because this one, of course, is an interim one pending a new constitution.
And just 10 days ago, Libya's deputy minister of electricity was assassinated. Is Libya falling apart?
Well, I think it has fallen apart. I mean, that in a sense is the result of, you know, Gaddafi hanging on to power for decades. Is that, you know, he squeezed the life out of you know, any kind of democratic institutions in the country. He didn't allow anything to flourish. You either were with the Green Book or you weren't, and that was the end of the matter. And you know, when you have the vacuum is suddenly filled, it's filled by with all sorts of people. And I think that's what we're seeing.
From Libya, let's move to South Africa. That's the last item for today's discussion. In South Africa, there is a rabbit in an ear. Martin, perhaps you'd like to explain the background to this one.
It's a rather sad story. There's a 9-metre-high statue of Nelson Mandela has just been unveiled outside the Union Buildings in Pretoria. You know, a wonderful setting, the seat of government, and the sculptors were told they were not allowed to engrave the statue with their names. So in revenge, they made a tiny rabbit and they put the rabbit inside Nelson Mandela's ear. Nobody noticed this for a few days, but somebody then looked and they found the rabbit, photographed it, put it on a website. And now, I'm afraid, the ANC has told the people this is an insult to Nelson Mandela's dignity. That rabbit's got to go.
Do you think, what's the reason for it being a rabbit?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that.
That's something I've been thinking for the whole day.
There's deep symbolism that resonates with South African politics there.
No, not really. I think it was just, I mean, for example, there used to be a man who made furniture in the UK and he was called the Mouse Man because every chair and every table he made, there was a little mouse carved into it. And I think it's the same kind of
it's
thing.
It's just a motif.
Yes, I think so.
We'll have to leave it there. That was Martin Plaut, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at Rusi with the Day's Top Stories. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us here at Midori House.
Thanks. Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty still to come on the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our women in Athens. We explore the future of NASA in Houston, pop over to Davos and review the top theater releases with Matt Wolf from the International New York Times. But before we get started on that, here is David Spencer with the world's news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. The Syrian opposition leader has called for independent international experts to visit Syrian jails to verify reports of alleged torture of detainees by government forces. Syrian officials could face war crimes charges after a military police photographer defected and provided evidence showing the systematic killing of 11,000 detainees. Syria's government has dismissed the claims, which emerged on the eve of peace talks, which have now got underway in Switzerland. Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych has met opposition leaders in a bid to defuse street violence in which three people have been killed. The talks are the first concrete move towards negotiating an end to 2 months of unrest. They ended after about 3 hours. Two Russian miners have died after a blast at a coal mine in Siberia. The Interfax news agency reports that 103 workers got evacuated from the site safely. A leading pro-government activist has been shot and wounded in the northeast of Thailand. Kwan Chai Praipana was injured when a gunman in a pickup truck opened fire with an assault rifle as he sat outside his home. Prominent Chinese rights advocate Xu Jiyang has gone on trial in the country's most high-profile dissident case in years. On the opening day, though, his lawyer said Mr. Xu refused to offer any defence and called the court unjust. And more than 1,500 flights have been cancelled in the United States after the East Coast was hit by another huge winter storm. Government offices in Washington, D.C. have been closed, as well as many schools. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David Spencer. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 22:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, and 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Athens, where our correspondent Natalie Savarikas is armed and ready with the week's top stories. Welcome to the programme, Natalie. Let's start by talking about terrorism. Greek authorities have said they may hand over a reward of up to 4 million euros for information leading to the arrest of some terrorists. Who are these terrorists in question?
Well, we have several in Greece. Like, the first one is Christodoulos Xiros. Now, he is the gunman of Greece's deadliest terrorist organization, November 17th. They were dismantled back in 2002. And he's been behind bars since then. However, he was actually on leave, on prison leave for New Year's Eve, and he never returned back. And since leaving, that's a few weeks ago, he's emerged now with a video and a text that he posted on this lefty website, and he's threatening more attacks against politicians and the judiciary and even people from the media in what he's been accusing them essentially for the being culprits of the current economic crisis. Now, he's one of them. There are others as well, including Nikos Mazyotis and his wife, who are also members of another militant group called the Revolutionary Struggle. And this group was also accused of various attacks, including firing a rocket-propelled grenade against the U.S. embassy in 2007, but also severely wounding a riot policeman in 2009. Of course, again, Christodoulos Xiros is the number one target here that the police are trying to get. He's been involved in countless killings, many bombings, again, against Greek, U.S. and British political and economic targets.
So how much of international pressure is there for Greece to catch Christodoulos Xiros?
Quite a lot. Actually, the U.S. Authorities have issued a statement where they're urging Greece to find him, essentially, again, because he was responsible for the killing of an attaché, of an embassy attaché, and there's a lot of pressure from the European authorities as well to apprehend this convict. And with his strong messages the other day, which were actually quite strange in the sense that he also outlined this entire political agenda of what he wants to implement in Greece and called on other members from the anarchist and militant left-wing world of Greece to back him on this.
Natalie, let's continue with a discussion on immigration in Greece. That is something that is heavily in the headlines now, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Essentially what we've had is, Greece up to 2012 was the main gateway for all irregular migrants hoping to get to Europe. 90% of all immigrants were passing through Greece. And unfortunately that means, because Greece has many thousands of islands, most of the immigrants, whether they're from immigrants or asylum seekers from Afghanistan, Syria, or Pakistan, Bangladesh, try to get through Greece, through the islands, using little boats. And one of them, yet again, capsized late on Monday night. 16 people were rescued, 12 were feared drowned. And now what we're hearing is, unfortunately, a mother and children were found dead, and many more are also dead because the boat essentially carried women and children. Of course, this is just a very tragic illustration of Greece and, of course, all of these countries on the borders of Europe have to experience on a weekly basis. I was in Mytilene, another island in the Eastern Aegean, just a month ago, and what they've been experiencing is essentially arrival migrants on a nearly daily basis, especially in the warmer days. And Greece has been experiencing very high temperatures lately, which has encouraged many migrants to take the boat and try to make it to Europe.
And after this latest incident, the UNHCR has expressed its concerns over what's going on over there. What does the organization actually want from Greece now?
Well, essentially what they want is for Greece to try and investigate the matter on how exactly it happened. Did the authorities react promptly? Are they taking all necessary measures? Of course, Greece is under a lot of pressure from the European Union to better patrol its borders. Frontex, the European Union's agency, is also actively involved here, helping the authorities to try and, help immigrants or essentially rescue them and avoid tragedies such as this one or such as Lampedusa that we saw in neighboring Italy a few months ago. But of course, the pressure is huge on Greece. As I said, 90% of all immigrants try to come through the border. The country is bankrupt and it's increasingly difficult for it to cope with all this wave.
Natalie, let's continue with a suggestion from American archaeologist Stephen Miller, who says that it would be a good idea to privatize some of Greece's archaeological sites.
Yes, well, you know, Greece, it's really funny. I mean, anywhere you walk, any rock you pick up, people will say they'll find something ancient, like under every rock. Even when they were building the metro back in 2004, they had serious delays because they had to stop every day because of all the sites they would uncover, whether it's stones or skeletons or ceramics. And so essentially what this archaeologist is saying is that there are so many sites that have been abandoned and haven't been utilized in any way by the government, they haven't been protected, especially now with the crisis. Why not, instead of abandoning them, just lease them to private entities who could commercialize them other than selling tickets? But why not, he say, build a hotel where visitors can actually come closer to all these artifacts and perhaps let the private entities build whatever they like under, of course, the supervision of the Greek state. And that will help Greece boost its tourism sector via this archaeological site. And But of course, you know, this has prompted a very heated debate in Greece. It's very proud of its cultural and historic heritage, and this is not only recently, but since always. I mean, even when they were building the Acropolis Museum just a few years ago, the architects were actually given instruction by the archaeologists on what to do, because that's how they tightly control everything that's linked to their history and archaeology. And of course, that poses great limitations on how the country manages its sites, and especially when there are many strikes in the country, and when in the summer months visitors are trying to come to Greece and see the famous Acropolis and the Parthenon Temple, just to see that they're padded and locked doors because of yet another strike. What this archaeologist is suggesting is, why not lease it to private entities? Of course, archaeologists here are saying that, well, we're just worried that they will not safeguard our heritage as well as we would. And that's the fear here.
That was Natalie Savarikas, Monocle's correspondent in Athens. Thank you very much for this. Up next, we are in Davos. Stay tuned for more on this edition of Midori House on Monocle 24.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. The time is 1841 here in London and 1941 in Davos, Switzerland, where we head now. Filled with high-level meetings and keynote speakers, the annual World Economic Forum has officially kickstarted today. We'll be covering the event for the next few days here on Monocle 24 with our colleagues at Bloomberg News. A bit earlier, we caught up with Bloomberg reporter Matthew Campbell, who covers deals and big business stories in Europe, and who is in Davos right now. I asked him about the big issues of the day, and here is what he had to say.
I think there are a few themes that are emerging. First of all, obviously everyone's mind is on the recovering global economy, strong growth in the US, somewhat weaker growth in Europe, Chinese growth that's slowing down a little bit, but still very impressive, 7.7%. So the mood is a little more buoyant than it has been certainly in a few years here. You hear that from business leaders, from political leaders, from people in the financial sector. But there are some reservations. There are certainly some dark clouds. One of them is the recent NSA spying revelations, which have been the subject of questions to various people today again and again and again. Marissa Meyer from Yahoo being pelted with questions about that and doesn't have a lot of great answers, because at the end of the day, this is a question more for governments than for technology companies whose hands are a little bit tied. So I'd say there is a cautious optimism or optimistic caution, and tempered with some real concerns that maybe this economic recovery isn't actually going to take off in the way that it seems to have started to.
If we talk more about NSA spying and cybersecurity, one of the big subjects over there, I think it's interesting to hear that there is indeed so much more to be said about these topics. What has the discussion been like over there? You already mentioned that Marissa Meyer has been faced with quite strict questions.
Well, there is a lot of concern. One of the concerns is that obviously President Barack Obama's primary objective in reassuring the American public about the extent of these programs and the way they are handled has been to reassure the American public as Americans, to say we are not spying on Americans. They are, of course, however, dealing with technology companies like Google, like Facebook, like Yahoo, whose real hopes for growth are abroad, whether it's in Europe, in Asia, especially in emerging markets. So while President Obama has taken some steps to reassure also non-American citizens that they're not being gratuitously spied on, when you speak to people in the technology industry, they say, you know what, we're trying to run global businesses, we're trying to grow, especially in new markets, and it's not helpful to be perceived as an arm of Uncle Sam, effectively.
How big a concern is the slowdown in emerging markets like Brazil or China?
Well, I think that's a huge issue, and actually with a couple of colleagues, I wrote a story that's in Bloomberg Business Week this week about whether globalization is reversing or at the very least stalling. And one of the things that is a very major factor in that is that the so-called BRIC economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, of those, we're really only seeing quite punchy growth out of China at this point. Brazil is barely growing. Russia has some terrible economic problems, of course, and India also has struggled a little bit. So it's a very interesting question when you talk about the BRICS being the great hope that actually for many companies, particularly companies based in North America or Europe, the BRICS haven't been such a great hope so far. In the long term, of course, they will be an important part of everyone's business, but some of those manifestations haven't appeared yet. In the last few weeks, we've heard some very interesting pieces of news about China. Two large American companies, Actavis, which is a pharmaceutical manufacturer, and Revlon, which of course makes makeup, have said they're actually pulling out of China because the costs and the risks of doing business there outweigh the potential gains. And I think that's a fascinating trend, considering that if we'd been having this conversation just a couple of years ago, the notion of a large multinational washing their hands of China would have seemed completely absurd.
Matthew, are we talking about just two individual cases over here, or are we talking about a wider phenomenon?
No, I think we don't want to overinterpret that. And of course, China is an enormously important economy and enormously important market for any large business. It is the second largest economy in the world. One day it will be the largest economy in the world. That is indisputable. But there are definitely bumps on the road and perhaps bumps that are a little bit bigger than some business leaders had anticipated.
And Matthew Campbell, whilst you are there looking ahead, what are you looking forward to the most?
Well, I think seeing certainly to turn from business slightly, both President Rouhani of Iran and Prime Minister Netanyahu from Israel are here. There were many eyes on President Rouhani today as he did what seemed like a fairly impromptu walk around the conference center flanked by dozens of cameras. Didn't answer any questions, but clearly a lot of people are very interested in whether the détente which we've seen with Iran will continue, whether he will engage with the international community while he's here, whether he'll engage with Prime Minister Netanyahu while he's here. That's going to be a big theme. Another theme people are talking about is inequality and whether the economic recovery, such as it is leaving some people behind, and what could be the effects of that. Big economies were built on middle-class consumption. If the middle classes don't recover with everyone else, then there will be big questions about the sustainability of some of these economic rebounds.
That was my chat with Matthew Campbell, a reporter for Bloomberg News in Davos. There is no doubt that NASA, America's one strong national space agency, isn't what it used to be, or at least it's not making the headlines that it used to. While lunar landings and Cold War pageantry are no longer the norm, there is still a lot that is going on at NASA. With the recent retirement of the space shuttle and the ever-present notion of civilian spaceflight, the organization has shifted gears. So what exactly is next for the organization that ignited the world's interest in space? Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister recently went to NASA's sprawling campus in Houston, Texas to find out. Here is his chat with NASA spokesperson Daniel Hewitt.
Orion is our next generation space vehicle. It's kind of our successor to the shuttle, if you will. What Orion's going to do, though, is it's going to carry astronauts beyond low Earth orbit. Low Earth orbit is this boundary that we kind of talk about. It's only a few hundred miles off the Earth's surface. We want to go thousands and millions of miles off the Earth's surface, and Orion's going to be the vehicle that's doing it. It's a capsule-based design, so it'll look a lot like an Apollo capsule to people who are familiar with spaceflight, but that's headquartered right here in Houston, the program, and that's where we're doing a lot of the research, design, and development for it.
When we think about the next steps, when we're going out to the million-mile barriers you're mentioning, what is out there? What is the goal for those sorts of missions?
Mm-hmm. So we're looking at Apollo and The Saturn V was the last rocket that took us beyond low Earth orbit, because the moon is considered beyond low Earth orbit. That's about 250,000 miles away. Okay, so the new rocket that we're building, the Space Launch System, is going to be the Saturn V, but bigger and more capable, because we're looking at multiple destinations now. So some of those targets are obviously the moon. Another target that we've been talking about a lot and we're doing a lot of research on are asteroids. We have an asteroid initiative out there right now where we want to actually go send a robotic spacecraft, capture an asteroid, tow it back to orbit around the moon, and then send astronauts in Orion to visit it, take samples. And this is more than just taking samples. You're then testing, sending astronauts farther away from home than we've ever sent human beings before. I mean, we're entering a really exciting time where, if you think about it, the furthest a human being has ever been from Earth is right around the dark side of the moon. If we send a person to an asteroid, we're getting further and further out until eventually we're knocking on the door for Mars, and that's where we all really want to be.
When we talk about a Mars mission, and I'm sure you probably get asked these questions a lot, because I think a lot of people think of that as the next step. Would the Orion rocket be a potential vehicle for that, or are we talking that's even a next sort of phase?
So the Space Launch System and Orion, which is the capsule, they would be part of that. Orion is an integral part because that's where your astronauts are going to be sitting when they leave the Earth, and that's the craft that they're going to be in when they come home. It's responsible for getting them off the Earth safely and getting them back through the Earth's atmosphere safely. And SLS is a rocket that's being designed that can launch all those necessary things. So when you start thinking about a Mars mission, it's a lot more complicated than just send astronauts, they go, they come home. When you think about the length of time, how much other stuff they would need to bring, would they need more habitats? Because you can't really be squeezed inside a tiny capsule for, 2 years with three other people. I think anybody would go crazy on that trip. So there's other things that they would have to send with them. Do we send things in advance? We have those capabilities, and the rockets are being designed to actually launch those things. So a Mars mission is very big in scope, and it's a huge challenge. But that's what we do. We look at these challenges. We want to tackle it. We want to get it done. So we're excited for it.
For you personally, you work for an organization that knows a lot, probably more than anyone else, about space travel. But there's only a handful of people in the world who've actually been to space. Is that ever odd for you? Sort of, you spend so much time sort of in this universe of this industry, but yet you have never been to space, and most people who work in this field never will go to space.
That speaks volumes about how difficult spaceflight is. And that's something a lot of people can forget, is because we can make it kind of look routine, but when you think about it, there are so many people behind every project just to get two people a few hundred miles up in the air. It's a very difficult thing to do. One of the great things about working in this organization is a lot of the people that work here, they're all engineer nuts, they're all tech geeks, that they love what they do no matter what. If it's something cool and they can sit in a lab and engineer it, they're going to love it. So not being able to go to space, not too much, but I plan on going to space at some point in my life, one way or another. I'm going to figure it out. But I mean, it's an atmosphere around here where everyone really is almost insanely enthusiastic about everything that they get to work on, and it helps a lot.
That was NASA's Danielle Hewitt speaking to Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we are fast approaching the end of the program. But as promised, just before that track, it's time for our daily review segment, where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors around the world. Today, we talk theatre. Joining me now in the studio is Matt Wolf, London theatre critic for the International New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Let's start by hearing a clip of a theatre play which opened last night.
There's no dark like a winter night in the country. And there was a wind like this one tonight, howling and whistling in off the sea. It was this type of night now. Am I setting the scene for you?
That was a clip of The Weir, a play that opened last night in London, and you saw it.
I did. That clip makes it sound like a horror movie, which it sort of is, but definitely isn't. This is actually the transfer to the West End for a commercial run of a production that opened last year at the Donmar, and the Donmar seats 250, so not many people could see it. Now it's in a theater that seats triple that, where very many people can see it. And it's a revival of a play that's been seen before. It's a really beautiful play about a community of people in rural Ireland where the wind is blowing, it's cold, you want to come in from the night air and have a pint or two or ten. And these mostly guys sit around trying to outdo one another with ghost stories. And then a woman who's just moved to the community comes in and she tells a real life ghost story. And I can't reveal another thing.
I can already see from your face when you were telling about that play that you enjoyed it a lot.
I did, particularly the performance of Dervla Kerwin, who plays the one woman in this sea of men who really are full of Irish bravura and braggadocio. And they kind of think, oh, cool, there's a girl now, a woman in our midst. That'll be impressive. And what happens is that she's so full of truth and emotion and feeling that she changes them before they have a chance to come on to her.
Shall we continue with something else you've been seeing recently?
Sure. Well, you want to talk about the Wanamaker Theatre?
Let's do that.
This is an extraordinary thing because it's a new theatre. We always talk a lot about new plays. We rarely talk about new playhouses.
Exactly. It's a new playhouse with old theatre in a way.
Yeah. very old theatre. They're currently showing two plays in repertoire. One is a Jacobean tragedy by John Webster called The Duchess of Malfi. And the other is a really lovely one-woman show with the great Dame Eileen Atkins, who's not far off 80, doing a series of lectures on Shakespeare that have been put together in theatrical form. The thing about the theatre that's really wonderful is that it is almost entirely lit by candles. So you're sitting with 12 chandeliers above you, each one with 7 candles. So if my math is right, that makes 84, plus another 30 or 40 candles waiting to come on. And it's a very, of course, unusual and beautiful atmosphere.
And when you look at those, when you think of the plays, is there anything you want to criticize them for?
Well, you know, the problem with being a critic, I suppose, is that we see certain titles a lot. So The Duchess of Malfi, with which the theater formally reopened last Wednesday, Gemma Arterton, the film actress playing the title role, Dominic Drumgoole, who runs the Globe, directing, very formidable talents. But the same play was done 2 years ago, 10 minutes down the road at the Old Vic, in a production with Eve Best that was just better. I mean, I have to say it was better. It was more spectacular. It was more dramatic. It was a lot sexier. So this is a rather subdued production of a really gory and fabulous play, but I don't think it quite delivers. The Eileen Atkins evening is wonderful. If you like Shakespeare, you'll particularly love it, because here's a woman who steeped her entire life in Shakespeare, giving you bits of, you know, she's almost 80. She's playing Juliet, who, of course, in Shakespeare's play is 14. So that's pretty wonderful.
We have one more play to talk about. Putting It Together.
Well, Putting It Together is a structural mess. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's a musical review of the work of Stephen Sondheim. But, and it's a very big but, the music is the great American composer lyricist Stephen Sondheim. So if you want to hear a lot of his great songs from Follies, Company, Merrily We Roll Along, A Little Night Music, this is the time and the place, but don't go for the structure.
Exactly. It sounds like some people are going to absolutely love that, and then the other ones.
I think it's a real sort of, if you want to see it, you'll already like it kind of thing. It'll appeal to the diehard musical enthusiasts who will be humming along, hopefully not too obnoxiously, and the crowd that wouldn't be into that won't go.
And what do you mean by structural mess?
Well, what this is a musical review, so it's not a fresh show. They've taken the pre-existing songs and they've woven a new narrative in which to showcase these songs. And it doesn't make any sense because the songs were written for particular shows, wedded to particular characters. And Sondheim writes for character very well. So if you strip the songs from the characters and then just throw them into a cocktail party, which is what this is, it's a cocktail party, they're going, oh, hello, and then they start singing a song from Follies or Company. And the song is great, but the context is daft.
Thank you very much. That was Matt Wolf, London theatre critic for the International New York Times.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed. And already that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next up, it's time for The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. Today we talk with the founders of music licensing company Audio Network.
For me, the thing that always interests me is that we might have commissioned a piece of music for a particular purpose, and when it's used in the wrong way, and suddenly you see tracks used in ways that just would never have occurred to us.
This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time for this edition of Midori House. It is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.